The goal of this lecture, y'all, is to get you familiar with identifying Tennessee anurans, Tennessee frogs and toads. Okay, we have 21 species in the state, of which you'll be required to identify 20 of them. And the other one is a gray tree frog. We have Cope's gray tree frog and then the gray tree frog. And we'll talk about the differences in those, but really for you to actually hear the difference, it's almost impossible, okay? All right, or to see the difference. There aren't any morphological characteristics to tell the difference, okay? And that happens to be the gray tree frog right there. Okay, so let's go through these characteristics. And as you recall from the syllabus, in about a month or so, maybe a little less, you will be required to remember this, and we'll have a quiz that will be both slides as well as audio recordings, and you'll need to be able to identify the species. You need to be able to provide the common name, correct spelling, as well as the scientific name, and that isn't good. So, bummer. Well, my laptops are still running. Okay. I will need to reboot. Well, first of all, let me go here and pause this thing. All right. Hello. Okay, good. Back with power. Okay. So, as you can see from up here, we're in the order Anura. We will go through Dr. Ecternot will be here for Thursday to lecture on reproductive strategies, but the next lecture I'll talk about amphibian evolution, the origin of amphibians, amphibian evolution, and basic taxonomy of amphibians. We'll talk about where amphibians are located within the animal kingdom, etc., where they come from. But we'll just jump straight into the order that the frogs and the toads belong to, and that's the order Anura. And there are three suborders within Anura, okay? There's Batrachia, Mesobatrachia, and Neobatrachia, okay? Now, within Tennessee, there are two suborders, Mesobatrachia and Neobatrachia, okay? And we have one species that is in Mesobatrachia, one family and one species, and that is the spadefoots. And specifically, it's the eastern spadefoot. We have, I think, four species of spadefoots in the United States. Eastern New Mexico, plains, and Couch's spadefoot. They're really neat. Really neat organisms. The family actually has just been changed. It's been Pelobatidae for forever, and they recently split it, and Pelobatidae refers to the spadefoots that are located over in Europe, and Scaphiopulpidae refers to our spadefoots that we have here within North America. Okay? All right, now the rest fall in the suborder Neobatrachia, and we have Bufonidae, which are the true toads, Ranidae, which are the true frogs, Hylidae, which are the tree frogs, and Microhylids, which are the narrow-mouthed toads. Okay, so we have five families that exist within Tennessee. Overall, within Anura, globally, there are about 33 families of anurans, and around about 5,200 species. And we, again, have 21 species of anurans here, five families represented. So we'll talk about, you know, where most of the species richness occurs, and actually, with respect to amphibians, the order Anura has the most species of amphibians globally, okay, compared to the other orders. In fact, it's about 80%. In fact, I might have that written down here. Yeah, 88% of the species are anurans. Okay. All right. Now, within our state, that's not the case. Okay, we actually have a lot more salamander species than we do frogs and toads. All right. Any questions? All right. So we have, yeah, two bufonids, one species of spadefoot, one species of narrow-mouthed toad, 10 tree frogs, and 7 true frogs, 7 ranids. Okay? And those numbers actually are on the syllabus when I handed them out, the very back page. By the way, if you weren't here on the first day, the handouts for the first day are over here. Okay, so those totals are down here on the bottom. Okay. Now, in order to kind of establish an understanding and talking about anuran morphology so that we can identify different characteristics, we'll start off with this slide. And on the top are representative frog species that may be within the family Ranidae or Hylidae. And on the bottom are is a representative photo or a diagram of true toads. Just from a general standpoint, you can certainly see there's difference in physical, just physical posture, physical morphology. The ranids, of course, your frogs, have more of a narrow-shaped head. There we go. Have more of a narrow-shaped head compared to toads, which is more of a square-shaped head. Generally smooth skin with most of the frog species as opposed to rough skin with the toad species. Now with frogs, with some frogs, not all frogs, they have what are called dorsolateral folds that are sometimes present that extend from up near the tympanum down the back, and if sometimes they're also absent as well. Okay, but those are called dorsolateral folds. And with the logical characteristics for the true toads is whether or not they have a cranial crest and the shape of the cranial crest, as well as whether or not it is touching the parotid glands, which are located directly posterior to the cranial crest. And in particular, for our two toad species, we'll actually look whether or not the parotid glands are touching the cranial crest or not. Of course, the rough skin of bufos you all are familiar with, and folks often call more, they're actually additional glands called glandular glands. And those the glands in toads are used as a predator defense, which we'll talk about later. Okay, so we have the cranial crest, the parotid glands, the glandular glands, which are the smaller glands that you can see raised surfaces on the skin. And then, of course, there are differences within just the shape of the feet, which often will put it into a family. Okay, so we have our toad species, which generally have more of a flat, kind of spade-shaped type foot that's used, you can definitely see it used for digging. They often have a spade on there, a tubercle on the bottom of their feet that helps with digging right here. And then, of course, your tree frogs usually have pads on the ends of their fingers. Usually not very well-developed webbing, but usually some webbing developed between the toes. And then the true frogs, there is no pads on the end, but they have very well-developed webs for especially to help them in more of an aquatic environment, which most of the true frogs are closely tied with. Okay? So basic morphology stuff. Okay? that all good? All right. Oh, yeah. Okay. So let's start with our first species, the American toad. And, okay, in the family Bufonidae. Now, when you look at this, just like when you identify anything in biology, you want to think about it in a hierarchical context. If you're first looking at something, the first thing you should do is try to put it within, for example, a family, a group of organisms, and then from there look at different characteristics. So what makes you think that that's a toad? What's that? Yeah, the warty, the very rough skin here, all the different glands that are here, etc. This is a top view because some of the characteristics that we want to look at for this particular species are best to be looked at from the top. But on the next page, I have it, a picture of an American toad from the side, which is very squatty posture, short limbs, and definitely feet that are not used for climbing or for swimming, but for digging. Okay, now, for the American toad, the characteristic that separates it from our other toad species, which is the Fowler's toad, is the position of the parotid glands. Here are the parotid glands right here. Okay, I think I might, there we go. And with the American toad, they do not come up and touch the cranial crest. Or if they do, it just comes up and just barely touches the very end of one of the crests, okay? That spur area of the cranial crest. So either they don't touch the cranial crest or it just comes up and barely touches it. That's a main characteristic to tell the difference between that and Fowler's toad. Okay, is that clear? The second characteristic refers to the glandular glands and how many glandular glands there are in each of the large dark spots that are on the back. Okay? And for the American toad, you'll only see one or two of these large glands, okay, per spot. In the Fowler's toad, there will be more than one or two, usually three or more. All right. Okay. Now this species breeds relatively early, in March, going into April and even into May. But often peak breeding season is early in the year for the American toad. All right. If you're looking in the water, Bufo eggs are very diagnostic. They are long strings. And if you ever see black eggs that are in long strings, it's going to be a toad species. You can actually tell the difference between our two toad species by whether or not, if you can see the entire egg mass. The American toad will lay anywhere, will usually lay 1 to 2 strings of eggs, between 4 and 12,000 eggs, but they will string them out for a very long distance, okay, up to 10 meters or even over 10 meters that they'll actually string them out through the vegetation, etc. Whereas the Fowler's toad likes to lay them much more compact. Usually within a couple of meters of each other, they'll wrap them all around. So that's kind of an interesting field characteristic, field note, if you're out and looking in the water at eggs. Okay? Now, the breeding call is can be described as kind of a long trill, a long musical trill that's constant. It doesn't change in tone. And hopefully I didn't get yet logged out here. Okay. So this is the call of the American toad. A long trill. Okay? Long, constant trill. What does that also sound like? You might want to make notes because you won't realize until you're going back through it later on unless you already know how to identify all these. But what does the American toad kind of sound like? They're all very different, really, once you get an ear for them. What else has a trill? Yeah, yeah, Fowler's toad. So you might just want to make notes. Similar species, Fowler's toad. The gray tree frog also has a trill, which you initially mentioned, Andrea. So, but they are different. And when you hear the other ones and you go back and you compare these and you practice, you'll certainly hear the difference. Okay? So a nice long musical trill. Now this is the state, the... A little bit different recording there. Okay. So across our state, they have a statewide distribution. American toads are found basically in the eastern U.S., not including really the coastal plain, the Gulf coastal plain. Okay. Now, on the top right here, or actually right after distribution, which if you print it off your slides, this isn't in there. I just added this in. I thought it would be a good thing to create some general habitat associations. So EM refers to emergent wetland. Okay, when I'm talking about that is I talk about emergent wetland, I'm talking about wetland with herbaceous vegetation. Wetlands with herbaceous vegetation. And EM will be emergent wetland, which generally it means emergent wetlands that are deep in the center, have a long hydroperiod. You'll see later I have EM-S, which is emergent wetland short hydroperiod. Those generally are species that are more explosive breeders. Their larvae develop much more quickly. Okay? F will be forested wetland. And that may include riverine wetlands, like long creeks, etc. And I'm trying to remember what else I have in there. Okay, if there are some other ones, I'll add to it when we get to them. Okay? All right. So any questions over the American toad? Pretty simple. Okay. Fowler's toad. Here we go. So they do look similar. However, one characteristic, as I mentioned before, is that the parotid glands come up and touch the cranial crest. Okay, as you can see in this diagram. It's a little bit difficult to see in that photo. The other characteristic is that there are multiple glandular glands per dark spot. Okay? Fowler's toads usually breed a little bit later than American toads, with a peak breeding season of around May. American toads are March or April, usually peak. And again, as I mentioned before, with respect to their eggs, they're laying about the same number of eggs, but usually they're much more compact in a smaller area. They're not strung out over a longer distance. So usually less than 3 meters in total area that they'll string them out. All right. Now, their call is a nasal wah, wah. And it's quite different than that trill that you heard a second ago. Okay, so Fowler's toad. Okay. So quite different than that American toad. Got it? Now, think in your head, make some, you know, word associations with this. Everybody thinks differently. Well, if it sounds like something like, oh yeah, that sounds like this, write it down as your own little note, okay? And that'll help you. Let's see, some folks have suggested it sounds like a sheep bleeding, or a baby crying, so, I mean, I don't know. You can think about it in that context. All right. Or you can make up a description yourself. Good? Pretty simple. All right. So, 19 more to go. All right. The distribution of the fowler's toad, again, emergent wetlands, they're really breeding in the same type of habitat as Bufo americanus, and they have statewide distribution. Again, here you're a good side profile, a nice squatty toad, and those parotoid glands come up and touch the cranial crest, okay? If I give you a picture, when I give you a picture, on the exam, at least one of the characteristics that I have described to you will be apparent. At least one of them. Maybe not more than one, because often more than one characteristic isn't displayed. Especially when we start talking about the tree frogs, and they vary a lot in color. They're very cryptic, depending on where you catch them. So, anyways, I, of course, will be very fair with respect to it. Of course, there will be some challenging ones, as there always are, which will really make you think. But as just a rule, you'll be able to see things. Now, I will always have a couple bonus ones, which will make you really kind of look at things and challenge you. But okay? Same with the recordings, too. They'll be all fair recordings that are very similar to these, if not the same recording. Okay. A good way to kind of test yourself is not only listening to, you know, the recordings that I have here, which are on the website when you download the interactive file for this presentation, but just go to other websites and listen to their recordings and kind of get that ear and practice yourself. All right. Okay, so fowler's toads are pretty much in the eastern United States, and they're statewide. All right, good. All right, the eastern spadefoot. Okay, now, we're in the family Scaphiopidae, so we're out of, or Pelobatidae. So we're out of the Bufonids. We have one species, this species, in the in this family. Okay. Now, when you look at that organism, what jumps out to you? Look like a frog or a toad? Yeah, it looks like a toad. They're squatty. It's a squatty organism. It doesn't have real long legs, or doesn't appear to have, you know, fingers that can grasp and grip and climb. So it doesn't look like it's a frog. So you should be thinking toad. And so either we're dealing with the American toad or fowler's toad, or this species here, the eastern spadefoot. And sometimes it's erroneously called the eastern spadefoot toad. It should just be called the spadefoot, eastern spadefoot. Okay? Now, you do notice they have glandular glands. Okay? just like the bufonids do, but they do not have paratoid glands. So that's one characteristic. Look for those big paratoid glands. They're not there. What's another characteristic?
Is that SVO? That stands for snout vent length?
Oh, yeah, my bad. Snout vent length. All right. So that's the measurement from the snout to the vent. And so one characteristic there is that these are a lot smaller. They're usually only a couple inches in length, whereas your fowlers and American toad, the adults at least, are about 3 inches or so. So they're certainly a smaller organism. Okay. All right. What else is apparent? Which you probably didn't notice from the other, but it's staring right at you. The vertical pupil. This is the only family that has a vertical pupil. Okay, so all the species of spadefoots have a vertical pupil right there. Okay, so that's another diagnostic characteristic. And again, as I mentioned, glandular glands, but no paratoid glands. Now, all toads, bufonids as well as your spadefoots, have this spade, called a metatarsal tubercle, that help them dig. And these guys are amazingly efficient diggers. And we'll talk about the spadefoots in general when we talk about post-metamorphic survival. They're often found, except for the eastern spadefoot, in xeric conditions, in very, very dry conditions. And this group, actually, I studied a couple of these species, PhD out in Texas, and they are awesome. For the couches spadefoot, they only need to come out and eat a couple times a year. And they will dig down to a meter deep to stay down by moist ground, and then they come out during thunderstorms in the summer. So they're amazing diggers. If you put them in soft soil like this, they will be gone in seconds. They back themselves and they dig backwards. They dig with their hind feet and with that spade, and they'll back themselves right in. And so their breeding season coincides with the summer, and specifically, they will not come out until there is some type of intense thunderstorm. There's been information that suggests that they need that cue, that thunder clapping, and that strong change in barometric pressure to actually stimulate and wake these guys up, so to speak, for them to emerge. So they will come on out during major thunderstorms. These are explosive breeders. They come down, they lay their eggs within a couple days, and their tadpoles can develop very quickly, within literally some of the species within weeks. Within 10 days, their tadpoles can develop and go through metamorphosis. So really adapted for for wetlands that have very short hydro periods. Okay, so they're coming out during the summer during thunderstorms. Now, their call is very diagnostic, very unique, and it kind of sounds like a crow off in the distance, kind of nasal grunts like wah, wah. And so some folks have described it as similar to a young crow. Okay, that's just one single one. Here are a bunch of them. Kind of sounds like a bunch of crows off in the background, doesn't it? And that's often how you hear them. You rarely just hear one of them. You hear a bunch of them because they all come out at the same time. Okay. They pretty much have a statewide distribution, except they're not found, they're located through the eastern United States and down into Texas a little bit, where they begin to overlap with New Mexico spadefoot and plain spadefoot. And as you get drier going towards the southwest, you run into Couchus spadefoot. Couchus spadefoot are the most adapted for dry conditions. And eastern spadefoot is the least adapted for dry conditions. Okay, so up here we have an EMS for emergent wetland with short hydro periods. Now, if the hydro periods are longer, their larvae will develop for longer. But in general, from my observations out in Texas, usually their tadpoles will go through metamorphosis in about 30 days at the most. And again, they can be faster. Right. So, southeastern United States, and they are rare up in the Smokies and the mountainous areas. All right. Okay. Any questions about them? Good. Okay. So, now we go on to our microhylid, the eastern narrow-mouthed toad, and it is narrow-mouthed, hyphenated, ED. So if you're asked, I may ask for the common name or I may ask for the scientific name. So make sure you're comfortable with both of those. These are small guys, only about an inch long. And what kind of jumps out at you when you're looking at that? What's that? Yeah, the head looks funny. You're darn right. And it goes along with its name, narrow mouth. And this one's usually one of the easiest ones to identify. They're kind of short, squatty. They kind of look like a toad, but they definitely don't have parotid glands. And they have a very pointed nose. They're also kind of fat. You can kind of see they're kind of squatty a little bit and really wide across. Another characteristic is that they have this folded skin between their eyes. And you almost really never need that characteristic just because, they're so unique as far as a group. But anybody have an idea what that folded skin is for? At least what it's been hypothesized. It's one of those trivia things.
More surface area?
Or?
Water and all
that. Okay. That's a good idea. It has to do with actually their diet and what they specialize in. Ants, yeah. Apparently this fold of skin helps protect their eyes and keep ants away from their eyes when they're foraging on ants. At least that's the hypothesis. Okay. These guys breed often when the spadefoots breed. They're summer breeders and they often come out with thunderstorms as well. Okay. Shallow wetlands, they have a very neat call. It's a buzz, sounds like insect wings. It's bzzz, bzzz. And I tell you what, man, these things are hard. I've been standing over them before, and them calling, and you just can't see them. They're really hard to actually see in the vegetation. But usually they're in very veggie-type wetlands. Lots of emergent vegetation. Okay. So let's listen to the narrow mouth. Buzz sound. Okay. That was one of my favorite favorite frogs? Like them. Okay. Nice buzz. Okay. They also have statewide distribution. They're located primarily in the southeastern United States. And again, like the spadefoots, they're pretty rare up in the mountainous areas of the Smokies. Okay, and again, as I mentioned before, they specialize in eating ants. So when these extra little tidbits about life history and things like that, make sure you make note of that. I'll have a few questions like that as well, a few written questions on the ID exam.
Did you say they specialize? Do they hang out and wait for one, or do they go looking for a nest, or what do they do?
I'm sure they actively seek them out. Yeah. Hang out by the water lines. Right. Well, they are. That's a good question, Jeremy. What I would think that they do is they're moving through the vegetation and they're foraging on ants that they encounter. But I doubt if they're heading up into the upland area searching for them. But good question. All right. Any other questions?
Are they classified like mammals in their diets?
What's that?
Like an anteater would be like a myrmecophagus.
I have no idea. Yeah. Most frogs are insectivores. And that for most of the species. I mean, so if you want to call them insectivores, that's generally the feeding strategy, the feeding habits they fall into. Is that clear?
Yeah. Okay. I just
didn't know if they're real specialized. In general, no, they are not. In general, what limits the food items that anurans eat is the size of their mouth. And pretty much anything smaller than it, they'll eat that comes by. Now these guys, one of the reasons that they may specialize in ants is because they have a relatively narrow mouth, and ants are obviously smaller than a lot of other insects or inverts that are out there. Okay, good question. All right, so next one. Now we're getting into the tree frogs, family Hylidae. And the first is the northern cricket frog. And this is a very small frog, and usually about an inch or a little bit smaller in size. And looking at that thing, what seems to jump out at you? Yeah, right. That's right. Although that neon green stripe is not always that apparent, okay? But that is one of the characteristics, is this neon green stripe and this dark triangle in between that basically lacks this pigment that comes down, okay? All right. Now, we also have the southern cricket frog, which is on the next slide, and one of the things that you'll see that is different is this stripe. And it's been suggested that the northern cricket frog, it's more bleated out. It's not in as nice of a line, as delineated of a line as with the southern cricket frog. Okay, it bleeds out more. And you'll see that on the next slide. The other way to tell it between the difference between it and the southern cricket frog is the webbing on the hind feet. Okay, For northern cricket frogs, they're mostly webbed. In fact, you can see the webbing coming up, the longest toe here, the middle toe, coming up almost at least past halfway of the length of the toe, three quarters to almost fully webbed. Whereas that is not the case with the southern cricket frog. They are webbed, but it's usually much less. You'll see the webbing way back here, less than half the length of the middle toe, that middle long toe. And so, again, if I give you a picture of these guys, I'll make sure that it's a representative picture that you can see that webbing, or that there certainly is a difference with respect to the coloring of that fluorescent stripe. Now, these guys are breeding right in mid to late spring and May. And their breeding call kind of comes from their name. Acris means locust, okay? And crepitans is clattering. So a lot of clattering noise, kind of sounds like locusts clattering. That's where it gets its name from, is actually from its breeding call. And it's a metallic clicking. It sounds like two metal balls being hit together. Some folks have described it sounding like a Geiger counter. Now, one thing that is different and very diagnostic between the northern cricket frog and the southern cricket frog is its call. They do sound similar. However, the northern cricket frog changes in tempo. It starts off slow, increases in rate, and then slows back down. Whereas the southern cricket frog is more constant, and also it's more steady. Okay, it's more steady. You'll hear that in just a second. Okay, so northern cricket frog. Here it's slowing down. Again, slow increase in rate. Then slow back down. All right. They are located, have a pretty wide distribution throughout really the Midwest and the eastern United States, excluding the northeastern United States. And they also have a statewide distribution, the northern cricket frog. Now you can see in this one here, again, that line is very faded, and sometimes it's even different colors. Okay, so again, you may or may not really see that nice line, but let's see here. Well, that's not a real good picture, but if I blew it up, you would actually see that webbing actually comes out to the end of the toe for the hind limb. Okay, these guys like emergent wetlands and that have very little shade, okay? So emergent wetlands that have very little shade. And they like to cling to the vegetation and sit on detritus and on the shore and call. All right, any questions about the northern cricket frog? All right, southern cricket frog. Looks very similar. All right. But again, now look at that stripe. It's more distinct than what it was with the northern cricket frog. Again, if it's there. They all have that lack of coloration, though. Again, here's that triangle between the eyes. Now, Right here, you can see, again, looking at that hind foot, that webbing only comes up less than halfway up the long, that middle toe, that long middle toe. There's much less webbing than if it was a northern cricket frog, which would extend much more and come up more up into this range. Okay? They're breeding later in the year, a little bit later than the northern cricket frog in the summer, June and July. And again, their breeding call is similar. For you entomologists, you know, gryllus is the translation is cricket, and it's a genus of crickets. And again, it sounds like two metal balls clicking, but it's much shorter, raspier, and it has a much more constant rhythm. So, southern cricket frog. Okay. It doesn't go for long, they don't go for long durations. Okay, northern cricket frog. So more of a metallic sound, very crisp and clear. Again, slow, fast, slow. As opposed to kind of a raspier. Okay, and kind of constant boom, boom, boom sound. Okay, is that clear, y'all? All right, now the other thing, you're not going to hear these guys unless you're in southwest Tennessee. They do have a far southern, deep south distribution. And so in middle and in East Tennessee, Cumberland Plateau area, there actually haven't been any documented recordings of the southern cricket frog. You need to be in southwest Tennessee. So where you are can help you out with this. Emergent wetlands and then /F forested, they are, when we were in Mississippi last year, we found some southern cricket frogs in a bottomland hardwood area. Okay, here's a good one here. Where's your nice metallic color? You don't have it. You still have that dark triangle, but it's a brown color now instead of a nice metallic green. But if you look down here in the water and you look at its webbing, you can see that webbing does not come up halfway up that long middle toe. There's very little webbing in that cricket frog. So that's the southern cricket frog. Okay? Again, it still kind of it has this stripe here, and you have your triangle, but it's not fluorescent. All right? Yeah, these guys are highly agile, very good jumpers. Same with the northern cricket frog. Very challenging to capture these guys and catch them by hand. They're fun. Okay, questions? All right. The next individual in Hylidae, the bird-voiced tree frog. Bird-voiced tree frog. And these guys, in fact, the tree frogs from here on out are all larger than your cricket frogs, except for Pseudacris, which is at the very end. But all your hylids in our state are going to be larger. They're going to be For example, average size of the bird voice is around 1.5 inches. Cricket frogs are pretty much an inch or less. Okay, bird voice, tree frog. All right. What does that look like? What jumps out at you? Yeah, it looks like a green tree frog. These guys, this is a caveat, this is a warning right now. These guys are highly cryptic and variable. So they can look green and they can look gray. So the most common things that they are confused with is the gray tree frogs, okay, either the copes or the gray, and the green tree frog, and possibly the barking tree frog, but they are quite different with respect to certain characteristics. All right, one of those characteristics is this light-colored patch under the eye, which is diagnostic to them, that light-colored patch. And it may be nice and fluorescent and green, or it just may be when this guy is brown, it may just be kind of more of a white tan color, but that patch will still exist, whether it is green or whether it is brown. And on the next slide, I have a picture of one that's more brown in color. All right, the other characteristic that will separate it from the gray tree frog is that gray tree frogs all have flash colors underneath of their thighs, okay, for predator avoidance. So, bird voice tree frogs do not have that flash color, which you'll see when we get to the gray tree frogs. Green tree frogs, again, if another characteristic of green tree frogs, which you'll see in a second, is that they have a nice white or cream stripe that comes down the side, which the bird voice do not.
So that flash color is supposed to confuse predators?
That's right. But you don't see a flash color here. There is no flash color here. When we get, you'll see that when we get to the gray tree frogs. When they jump, when they jump, it's a bright flash and it startles the predator for hopefully long enough for them to get away. That's right. Okay, so they don't have the flash color like the gray tree frog, which would be in that region. Okay, their breeding, May and June is when their peak breeding season is. And these guys are highly arboreal, primarily breeding in forested wetlands and streams, and they only come down basically to breed. They often call from an overhanging branch, etc. So they're highly arboreal and rarely come down to ephemeral wetlands next to a stream or some type of vernal pool, except to breed. And they climb back up the tree. All right, these guys are really a simple call, much like the narrow-mouthed toad. They're very diagnostic. They sound like a bird call, hence their name. And I guess some folks have suggested they sound kind of like you're whistling for your dog. Let's see, bird voice. As we get through some of the recordings, I'll start asking you what we're hearing in the background too. In fact, that's one of my, that'll certainly be one where I ask you how many different species do you hear and write down the species. That'll probably be one of the more challenging questions. So multiple species chorus, and we can practice some more with those too, as far as multiple species chorus. What is that in the background? Maybe. Yeah. Come on, where are my amphibian folks?
Chorus frog.
Chorus frog? I don't know. I didn't hear a chorus frog. Did you? There may have been. We haven't gone over it yet.
Green frog.
Green frog, yeah. Okay. Good job, Matt. Let's see. Okay. These guys also, you're just going to hear them in West Tennessee. And they really have a distribution that is primarily within the Mississippi Alluvial Valley, of course, although it does extend over into Alabama and Georgia, but primarily the Mississippi Alluvial Valley region. There you go. Here's a gray-faced one right here. Let me turn off the lights. Not a gray-faced one. Again, they really are cryptic and adapt to the surrounding environment. Again, you do not see any flash colors here. And here is that light patch under the eye. The other thing you'll see with the gray tree frog is a lot more mottling on the back when we get to the gray tree frog. Or gray tree frogs. Okay? How do they change colors? Oh, golly. I guess that's a good question for you to research for your paper. Well, we'll talk about different cryptic coloration and what they mobilize to change their colors, etc., later on. Relatively quick, actually. I would within an hour, I would say. Within a minute or two, even faster than that, Casey. There you go. Yeah, they're pretty quick. Yeah. You can. A lot of frogs are that way, especially tree frogs, that they really are. Adapt and change their color to their surrounding very quickly. Their tadpoles are the same way for many species. Okay, of course, these guys are more in forested wetland areas. All right. Any questions? All right. One of the species that you might confuse the bird-voiced tree frog is the green tree frog. But what is kind of jumping out at you here? Yeah, that nice white, yellow, mid-lateral stripe that comes on down. Okay? And that's a very diagnostic characteristic of a green tree frog. These guys are always green, to my knowledge. Although you never say always in biology, right? But they have a smooth back. You're going to see them green, and they have mid-lateral stripe coming down. A little bit larger too than the bird voice. Of course, that's sometimes kind of hard to see on a photo. All right. So there's that mid-lateral stripe. These guys are breeding during the summertime, during June and July. And they have a very unique call. Again, this is another easy call. Kind of sounds like a bicycle horn. They're pretty neat. So these guys, you hear them in West Tennessee and down in Georgia and Alabama. Oops, wrong one. What's that? There we go. There we go. That's a good chorus there. multiple species chorus. So what other one can you hear in that real easily? Cricket frog. There are two other species there that we haven't talked about yet. Okay. All right, so that's the green. Green tree frog. Okay? Pretty easy one. And again, they have a western distribution in our state, although one was found at Seven Islands Wildlife Refuge last year. And don't know how it got there, whether it's a real record or an introduced record, who knows. But there was one out just east of here in Knox County. But they have, in general, you can see the deep southeast distribution and even up the Atlantic coast a little bit, and a western distribution in our state. Okay. Primarily forested wetland areas, although they'll be anywhere, they'll be around swimming pools but they do prefer forested wetlands and occasionally see them in emergent wetlands. Okay, any questions with those guys? There's that nice stripe there. Yeah, very good. Up at the top there, that note, very good climbers. Okay, so Cope's gray tree frog, next species. And again, this might be confused with the bird-voiced tree frog, although here's that modeling that I was talking about. Gray tree frogs generally have modeling on their back, which help you tell the difference between it and other species, especially the bird voice. And here are the flash colors here that you can see, okay, either orange or yellowish in color. So they're gray to greenish in color. Actually, the gray tree frogs can have a green color to them as well, which I think I have on the next slide. But they have that modeling on the back and the flash colors as well. So yellow to orange flash colors under the legs, right there. Their peak breeding season is May and June. And these guys, again, also are highly arboreal, primarily breeding in forested wetlands. Now, I mentioned that this call, the gray tree frogs, is kind of similar to the American toad because it's a trill. But it is quite different. Okay, it's a raspy trill, it's constant. And again, the only way that you can tell the difference between the Cope's gray tree frog and the gray tree frog is by actually analyzing the call. The Cope's gray tree frog is faster than the gray tree frog. And there is software that's out there that can actually analyze it. It's in a range of 30, 40, 69 pulses per second for the Cope's gray tree frog. You can also analyze them genetically. The Cope's has half the chromosomes of the gray. So let's go ahead and listen to the gray tree frog. Ah, that's actually the gray tree frog. My bad. Here's Cope's. Okay. So a very fast trill. Now, Here's the American toad. The other thing is think about too, hear how long this is. American toads are a lot larger and they have these huge, huge vocal sacs that they fill up with air and resonate the call. Whereas the gray tree frog, a much smaller vocal sac, and so that trill is much shorter. Okay? But they are, nonetheless, they are two different trills. American toad. Cope's gray. Okay? Now the gray tree frog, which is we're going to talk about in just a second, is again that trill, but you're only going to hear the copes. You're just going to hear that one. And just to play it though for you, it's a little bit slower. Almost more of a chirp in some capacities. Almost sounds more of a chirp. Okay. All right. The Cope's gray tree frog has a statewide distribution and really kind of found great. This is actually for gray tree frogs in general, have an eastern United States distribution. We're just starting to get information on the distribution of gray tree frogs, versicolor, Hyla versicolor, and it's believed through analyzing their calls that they primarily have a western distribution, which is right here. Okay, versicolor. Again, everything's the same with these guys, except that their call has less pulses per second. It's a little more crisper, and they also can be determined their species can be separated also genetically.
So many chromosomes does the cope have?
Well, that's a good question. I didn't look that up, but that's a good question. I'll find that out for the next lecture. Good question. So it's believed they have a West Tennessee distribution. Okay, and there's those flash colors again. And now this is a species of concern, the gray tree frog. And I hand it out, it's considered as a, you'll see that this is the lowest level of concern. In fact, it's actually from a state listed standpoint, really, and from a federal standpoint, they're not really of much of a concern, but it is listed as a species of concern with respect to management within the state, primarily because we don't really know a whole lot about them. And really don't have a good feel for their distribution, but we are now recognizing that they definitely have there's a lot fewer of versicolor out there than the Cope's gray tree frog. We are starting to recognize that, and that's really raising concerns at the state level. So you'll notice that there'll be a couple other species where it says species of concern in our state, and here's the codes. You have your global ranking, G1 through G5, our state ranking, S1 through S5. Okay, here's a green phase one here, the one that's green colored up on top. Okay, so the gray-green tree frog, right? You won't see that type of modeling in any of the tree frogs that are that could be green in our state. Okay? All right. What's that? Bird voiced. Bird voiced tree frog. That is a good guess. What would be another good guess?
Barking tree frog.
Well, yeah, if you knew what it was. Yeah, it the green tree frog and the bird voice tree frog would be the green tree frog and the bird voice tree frog would be a good guess. Except, what are we missing for the green tree frog? The stripe. What are we missing for the bird voice? Mark under the eye. Okay? So this is the barking tree frog. And often, the barking tree frog, these guys, their color changes a lot as well. But they'll often have black spots on the back, but of course not always. Okay? So if they are solid green like this one, the other thing is between it and the green tree frog is that they're much more, their skin's much more, looks much more granulated than the green tree frog. You'll see that on the next slide. And the big thing is it does have this white upper lip similar to the green tree frog, but it doesn't extend back mid-laterally. Their season is the same time as the green tree frog, June and July and midsummer. And they have a pretty diagnostic call, kind of a steady raspy honk, kind of sounds like maybe a beagle that has treed something or chasing a rabbit, or maybe a Canada goose. Now, that call sounds similar, actually, in my opinion, it sounds a little bit similar to the green frog. So make a note of that. When we hit the green frog, we'll hear the difference. But it's much higher pitched than the green frog, which we've actually heard a couple of green frogs in the background, which is kind of a low, kind of thug type sound. That is analogous to what folks call a banjo string, kind of plucking a banjo string. This is a much higher pitch than that. Okay. These are the largest tree frogs in Tennessee. Okay, 2 to 3 inches in length. The barking tree frog. Right? And they kind of, their call kind of represents that. It's a nice, loud, booming call. These guys are located primarily in the deep south, and they do have a, well, they've been basically found in some areas of the Cumberland Plateau. So West Tennessee and the Cumberland Plateau is where they've been documented. And this is another species of concern in the state. It's listed as G5 globally, so not that big of a deal from a whole region, but within the state, it's listed as S3. S3 is rare and uncommon in the state. 21 to 100 occurrences have been documented. Okay? Of course, we are right on the northern edge here of their distribution. Okay, and forested wetlands. These will actually climb down to the water and actually call from the water, whereas most tree frogs prefer to hold on to an overhanging branch and call from it. Okay, but these will call from the water. They're probably the largest tree frog, and they're probably the most clumsy of the tree frogs as well, as far as agility. Okay, there's that granulated green skin that I mentioned. You can really kind of see how bumpy it is compared to the green tree frog. Okay. All right. Spring peepers. Frogs, which pretty much almost everybody has heard. Characteristics, what jumps out at you? Mm-hmm. That cross on the back, right there. And sometimes it is not real distinct. You don't really see a nice distinct cross here, so don't be too confused. But a nice, small, this is a very small frog, about an inch, very angular head, and light. They're always white. They could be a little bit darker than this, but really usually very light in color, even pink almost sometimes. And they this one's a nice cross here, but a cross pattern. And actually, crucifer means cross bearer. Okay, so that nice dark cross in the back. So they're usually pretty easy to tell a difference. Now, another characteristic is that dark line between the eyes as well, which you do see there. That'll always be there. The distinctness of the cross may change, though. All right. Again, as their name indicates, spring peeper, very early breeders. Not our earliest breeder, but we're talking February, March for spring peepers. And they prefer woodland pools, but they also are found in emergent wetlands. Okay, these are spring peepers, pretty much I think everyone has heard. If you haven't, or didn't know what you're listening to, here you go. Hey, what's that? All right. Now, what does that sound like? Obviously, it's a Canada goose, but you will hear them just individuals too, like that, when they just start calling. Just a few of them out there. And of course, that last one was a whole chorus of them. So, very clear, Pete. Okay. Can't really think of any other species that you might confuse that with, other than maybe the bird voice, but this is a very clear chirp as opposed to the bird voice is much more louder and kind of more of a whistle. Okay. They have statewide distribution and pretty much are found throughout the eastern United States. There's that nice cross. The back, and again, they're found in forested wetlands and emergent shallow wetlands. Where there's water, you'll find spring peepers. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, mountain chorus frog. Mountain chorus frog. Okay, looking at this, what's the image? What jumps out at you? What characteristic? Yeah, look at this nice dark stripe. Okay? That's how you're going to tell it the difference between it and potentially you might get it confused with maybe the spring peeper, maybe the chorus frog or the cricket frogs. But that nice dark stripe through the eye is the primary diagnostic characteristic. Okay? There is one other frog that has that, and that is the wood frog. But the wood frog is about three times the size of it. It's a ranid, and it looks like a ranid. Long legs, jumping, swimming, ranid. This is still in the tree frog family. Okay? The other characteristic that sometimes is apparent, okay, there's your dark line, is this pattern on the back here. They call it backward parentheses, but it's not always that apparent. So, anyways, that is also another characteristic to go by, is that this dark pattern forms backward parentheses. Okay? And that's what it means, backward parentheses. But that line through the eye is a dead giveaway. All right. And really the only other species that has that is the wood frog, which is a lot larger. Okay. These guys are breeding early, up in actually higher elevations, usually above 1,000 meters in elevation in mountainous areas of Tennessee and elsewhere. Usually early in April. Mountain chorus frog. They have a short raspy call that rises in pitch. It sounds similar to the southeastern chorus frog, which is running your finger over a comb. And it's a really good description, actually, but it's much duller than the southeastern chorus frog, which we'll hear in just a second. Okay, so mountain chorus frog. Kind of thing. Now I'm just going to play right now the southeastern. It's just quite different, but similar. Again, it's the southeastern chorus frog here, running your finger over a comb, but it's very clear and metallic. Whereas the mountain chorus frog, you still kind of think about that running your finger over, but it's much duller. It's not very metallic. Okay. All right. These are primarily found in the Cumberland Mountains, Cumberland Plateau area, and the Smokies. So they have a kind of a southern Appalachia distribution and extend down into Georgia. Okay. Forested wetlands as well as emergent wetlands. Forested wetlands as well as emergent wetlands. At high elevation, over 1,000 meters in elevation. Okay, so if you're not in those regions, you're going to be hearing the southeastern chorus frog. Okay, and they do look a lot different. Their calls are similar, but they do look a lot different. What jumps out at you here? Southeastern chorus frog. Yeah, those three lines. Okay, and those are diagnostic of the southeastern chorus frog, also this dark triangle. These three lines, as you can see this one broken up, again, these are characteristic, but these lines do break up. You'll still see some portions of them, but they will not always be nice, solid delineated lines. But that's a very clear characteristic. Again, these are small guys here, an inch long. So, nice, dark, three dark dorsi. And then this dark triangle between the eyes. These are our earliest breeders. They will start breeding January. I just heard some the other day when I was coming out of Food City. So these are our earliest breeders. And again, we just heard that call These are in January, and you hear something, it's going to be southeastern chorus, or it's going to be, well, could be a couple different things, but southeastern chorus and spring peepers are the most common. Actually, also wood frogs are, but we haven't got to those. Let's see here. So, okay. And running your finger over a comb. Yeah, I put that note down there because some folks get it confused with the gray tree frogs, except gray tree frogs are a trill that does not rise. You notice how this call rises. Again, it rises in volume. And you don't hear that with a gray tree frog, which is just a constant trill. All right. Southeastern chorus frogs have a statewide distribution, and this distribution here includes all three subspecies of chorus frogs. But the southeastern, southeast, I have another range map here in just a second. Okay, they prefer emergent wetlands, shallowly flooded. So here's the distribution of chorus frogs. States. The southeastern chorus frog is the upper chorus frog is then we have the western chorus frog as well. Okay, so ranids. We have seven species of ranids, and the first one is a relatively rare species, the crawfish frog. And what kind of jumps out at you here? First of all, just looking at it, doesn't look like a toad, right? And doesn't look like a tree frog, has these long jumping legs. So you know it's a ranid. One of the characteristics here are these dark spots that are encircled in white. And that's a really, this frog only looks similar to the gopher frog, which is the next slide. And that's a key characteristic, is that the circles, these dark circles, will be encircled in white for the crawfish frog. It also, if you can see underneath, it has a white throat, whereas the gopher frog actually has a spotted throat. Okay. Dorsolateral folds are apparent, but again, a lot of the ranids have those folds coming down the back, and actually some don't also. Okay, these are early breeders in March, and you're going to hear these guys in West Tennessee. These live, and hence they get their name, they live in crawfish burrows, often associated with crawfish and small mammal burrows. Okay, the breeding call is a deep sounds like somebody snoring. What are those other ones? What were the other? Yeah, peepers. So just think of somebody just really, really inhaling deeply while they're snoring. Okay. And this is a species of moderate concern, G4 and S4. S4 is widespread, abundant, and apparently secure within the state. but the reality of it is we really don't know a whole lot about its distribution. Hence, it's listed as a species of concern in our state, or a species of interest. Another picture here of the crawfish frog. Again, there's those dark spots encircled in white. Emergent wetlands, West Tennessee distribution. Okay? And they really do have a very restricted distribution within the Mississippi Alluvial Valley. Oops. Oh, yeah. These guys will eat crawfish that come into their burrows, as well as other small amphibians that come near the burrows. All right, we'll do one more and we'll call it a night, since this guy's similar, the gopher frog. And this is the, I guess, the most least known, least studied, least understood frog. Had one. And we'll talk about where that occurred in just a little bit. And generally, from a regional perspective, these frogs are generally not doing real well. They're often associated with gopher tortoise burrows, which also have not been doing well. So, but one thing to notice here between it, it does kind of look similar to the crawfish frog, although the spots are not encircled in white, and it has a spotted throat. That crawfish frog does not. It's a nice white cream color. And they're about the same size. Gopher frogs are can be a little bit larger, but about the same size. And the sacral humps in the back are often very apparent, too, in gopher frogs. Let's see. Yeah, they're good. Okay, these guys are breeding early. Even a little bit earlier than crawfish frogs, February. And all from beneath the water. Okay, they have another kind of snore, but it's more of a drawn out snore, and even kind of sounds like a growl compared to the crawfish frog. Here's another one I've got. Compared to oh, yeah, that's the other characteristic I had. Once I heard that, to me it sounds like it's a woodpecker pecking. Yeah, the gopher frog. Kind of, it's a little bit faster with respect to number of pulses than the crawfish. Okay. All right, again, this is a species of concern because we've only had one documented case within the state, but also regionally, it's also considered of concern, considered a vulnerable species, G3. And it really has, you know, there's our one spot right there, okay, on the regional map, really a coastal distribution and Gulf Coast distribution. One record in Coffee County near Tullahoma, Dr. Brian Miller documented that with his students. So we really know very little about the life history of it in Tennessee, although it's generally associated with emergent wetlands near gopher tortoise burrows, and they stay in the gopher tortoise burrows when they're not out in the wetland either breeding or foraging or whatever. Okay? So we have, I think, five more frog species to go through. Start practicing these and going through them, both by sight and by call. And we'll finish, actually, the remaining species up next Tuesday because Dr. Ecternot will be here on Thursday to talk about reproductive strategies of amphibians. And I think primarily anurans. Okay, any questions, y'all? All right, start practicing.